men.
Thank goodness LinkedIn didn't go down, unlike yesterday when almost every other platform crashed.
Right?
That was a surreal day. What we're talking about, very briefly, because I really want to talk about Jyoti, is that we lost Facebook Messenger and Instagram yesterday for 6 hours, which was an interesting experience. But how did it impact you in any way?
I was secretly really relieved that it was offline because I actually write a lot and think a lot about how technology is changing the way that we behave and communicate. And honestly, I allowed myself to imagine what life would be like without it, and I wasn't too sad at all.
I took the dog to the park for a walk, did some meditation, thought about, you're right, though I must confess my addictive side did jump onto Twitter and had a lot of fun with the memes.
Yes, I did see that too and thought it was hilarious. But no, Twitter's great. There's none of the fluff. It's just raw ideas, raw words, which is so great.
The only thing that did panic me a little bit was that I use Facebook as a global address book. You're from another country, so you understand that, keeping track of a global community, a global friendship. So I'm tracking down everybody's phone numbers and emails.
It's a good idea. It's a good idea. And for sure, using apps like Signal instead of WhatsApp are also great ways to just wean ourselves being dependent on these big tech companies,
That is fantastic advice. I think there's also Telegram, and I know Anchor didn't go down, and a few others. So we do have options. But back to
Indeed.
more important things. Jyoti Patel is a creative coach and consultant, and she guides bold, visionary leaders to develop creative, inclusive, and impactful organizations, which we so desperately need. These organizations can usher in the future of ethical leadership and innovate in response to the defining issues of our time with her strategies. And she's the founder of Spill Play, which is such a fantastic name. And it's a Seattle-based, even though Jyoti is British, and I want to ask about that. But Spill Play is a Seattle-based organizational culture and strategy consultancy. And you can jump on the website, which is, and I'm going to spell it, Spille play.com. Where did the name Spill Play come from? Because I believe it has a meaning.
It does, yes. So spill actually means play in Danish, believe it or not. And there's two words for play in Danish. One is the root word of Lego, which many of us are familiar with. And Lego means unstructured play, using your imagination. Spill means structured play, play with purpose, play with intention, with rules, with boundaries. And to me, when I first started my business, I knew that all of the culture development, strategy development work I did, I wanted to do that using playful and creative methods because after spending many, many years in corporate as an engineer and as a manager, I realized that what we need more than anything else is the capacity to play and be creative. It's one of those things that we learn. Like as soon as we're born into this world, we're innately creative and playful. And the older we get, the more we kind of learn how to put a lid on it in order to navigate these professional spaces. And we lose some of that magic, that creative magic. So to me, being playful and being creative is something that is baked into who we are as humans, as mammals. We observe all animals kind of playing, and play really is our brain's best way of learning. So I'm a big advocate for play, and that's where the name came from.
It's brilliant. All corporations should have a box of crayons. And I noticed on your website there was a picture of Lego.
Yes, I do use Lego bricks as a communication medium. And it's actually a really powerful tool for adult learning and strategy development because we can build models of ideas that usually don't make it outside of our brains. And you know, a lot of the issues and challenges that organizations and leaders face today are quite complex, and they're quite cultural. And so it's really hard for us to talk about some of these, you know, wicked problems and cultural problems without feeling stressed. And so Lego bricks are one of the great tools that I use to just make it easy to talk about some of these, you know, thorny, wicked problems without it being stressful, so that it can be a productive and enjoyable experience.
Because who doesn't want to sit on the floor and play with Lego? I always
right
under colors, but what a great way of making a safe assuming that your corporate leaders aren't fighting over who gets which bit. So
yeah, I mean, corporate leaders probably need to learn how to play nice more than my kids even. But yeah, no, you're 100% right.
Danish word. What inspired you to pick a Danish word? Was it because of Lego?
Yeah, it actually was, you know, and when I first started my business, Lego was one of the core tools I was using. Since then, I've expanded and use a variety of creative mediums and methods. But yeah, at the time, I was very inspired by Legos, and also just by the discipline and design, kind of the philosophy of using good design that is just so prevalent in Europe and in Denmark in particular. And it's actually really funny that we're talking about this, because, you know, last year after the protests erupted and the Black Lives Matter movement really gained steam, I had a chance to reflect more deeply on the name of my business and really was challenged to think about how I can integrate and honor global wisdom and indigenous wisdom and the wisdom of just other cultures, and kind of breathe more life into the work that I do, because I do draw on a lot of different methods and approaches. You know, I'm Indian, and my parents were born in Africa, and I've traveled extensively, and I know that you're a global citizen too, Erin. So, you know, so much of what we have to learn these days is about integrating different cultures. And so it's been quite the journey. But yeah, I think that for me, really growing up in Europe, but still having strong roots in other parts of the world, is really challenging me to be to just honor the fact that there are many different methods and approaches that we need to celebrate, and not just the European ones, right? And so yeah, that's a little piece of that story.
Here's the celebrating worldwide play.
Yes.
You're British. How did you end up from, I mean, I, how did you get from Britain, and what part of Britain are you from, to Seattle?
Yes. So I was born and raised in West London, and grew up kind of really exploring the city. I went to school in Westminster and traveled on the bus and the tube every day, you know, as a child. And my dream as a kid, like probably since I was about 10, was to be an astronaut. So I was one of those kids that was obsessed with space, obsessed with kind of adventuring. And, you know, when I was 17, I decided to pursue advanced education in the US. And so I moved to the US in 1999 to study mechanical engineering and pursue kind of a career doing flight and space flight in particular. So that's what brought me to the United States, and really was kind of how my career started to take shape, was in this kind of innovation, space, flight realm. So yeah, that's how I got here.
Speaking of astronauts, there was just a recent flight that had four civilians go up for the first time.
Yeah, was that through Virgin Galactic, right?
Oh, that would have been hilarious because I'm sure Richard Branson would have gone too. But no, it was through SpaceX. It was through Elon Musk, who definitely has a playful sense of humor. There aren't many people that put sports cars circling space. But I just do you still hold the dream of being an astronaut, or did it because now you are leading people in a completely different way. I mean, you're looking at the world space, but you're looking at the world from a different point of view now.
Correct. Yeah. So, well, what ended up happening was after I graduated, and what brought me to Seattle was my first job was flight testing airplanes. I was a flight test engineer with Boeing, and so I was for many years I was part of a integrated flight test team, and I was part of the team that tested the first ever 787 Dreamliner aircraft, and yeah, had a chance to really dig into, the magic of flight, at least from a commercial perspective. And over the years, when I worked in aerospace, I did have a chance to work on satellites, on fighter aircraft, on helicopters, and all sorts of really cool products. But through those years, through those 13 years of working for a large global corporation, I realized and I learned that the biggest challenges facing humanity are not technical. They're not engineering challenges. As much as we might like to think we can solve, our biggest problems in a technical way, I now understand and fully believe that our biggest challenges are behavioral and social, psychological, and so much of, how we show up in this global moment. If you think about what's happening right now, where there just feels like it feels like there's so much division. Really, the solution to that is understanding how culture and, the implicit realm of our beliefs and stories really shapes who we are and how we show up and how we make sense of the world. And so that is where my heart is now. And so I've done the engineering thing, I've done the space flight thing. I'm not going to be an astronaut, now. Although I do remember looking up jobs and being qualified to apply to be an astronaut. But yeah, I that's not where my heart is at all now. And no looking back. I'm fully invested in helping shape organizational and systems change.
Well, there are people that are very glad that you decided to stay on the planet. Glowing testimonials from companies like Boeing. So I'm glad you kept your feet on terra firma.
Thank you. Me too.
I can understand how your experience with those companies and being an engineer, you've obviously got a high ability to strategize and also to be able to translate, to be able to have a bridge of communication between subjects as difficult as and empathy, and translating that into methods that will help people work through a process. So great, great intersection there. Speaking of cultural biases, I know that you want to help people overcome these. Would you mind giving me an example of some of the cultural biases you've come across?
Well, oh, there's so many, but I think one that's been coming up for me is just the how we perceive and make sense of our value as humans, as human beings, and so when I first left corporate to start my own business, I became really hyper aware of the fact that my own worth was very much based on what I was delivering, how productive I was, how much money I was making. And as an expert in creative thinking and creativity, I understand now with much more kind of depth that our belief that our value as humans comes from how much work we do is really quite damaging to the creative process because in order to create and use our imagination and to really do our best work, we can't be stressed. We can't be under too much pressure, at least when, if that's triggering a fight, flight, or freeze response in our bodies, because our nervous systems, when they're under a stressed out state, actually it impacts the way that our brains and our our neural processes are working. And so we have this very widespread belief that our value as people comes from, how much money we have, how much we produce, how much we deliver. And even if we don't want to believe that, that culture is so pervasive that deep down, I think all of us kind of believe that at some level. And so, that's an example of one belief, and it's related to perfectionism. It's related to kind of a culture of shame and of self-harm and of a lack of self-esteem and an over focus on how we look versus how we behave. And especially as women, there's so much of gender and race that's interwoven with our hyper-productive culture. But yeah, it is harmful because in organizations, we don't really stop to ask the deeper questions. We don't necessarily make the time and space to be able to interrogate these beliefs because so often we're just racing ahead without really looking at the big picture and without really thinking about the implications and the underlying assumptions that guide what we're doing. So yeah, those are some examples of cultural biases that are very, very pervasive.
That was a big question I threw at you. Thank you for handling that so beautifully. If I may follow up with saying, as you mentioned, it can lead to harmful products tied into these biases. The pressure to show the world we make a lot of money, the pressure to show the world that we work very hard. Would you say that leads to that? You say that leads to tangible products that can actually help keep the perpetrate the cycle.
Yeah, well, for sure, and we're seeing this play out on a global stage right now. Like you just mentioned, like at the beginning of this interview, how Facebook went down, and another thing that happened, the day before yesterday was there was a whistleblower that came out from Facebook and was talking about how the company was, very aware of the harm that social media does on young developing brains, and in particular young girls, rates of depression, rates of suicide, rates of just mental health issues are on the increase with our young people. And if you think about, the products that are being pushed out by, big tech, but by lots of industries, quite frankly, there's, if you think about the byproducts or the unintended consequences of what we're designing, then there are ripple effects. And in the case of technology products, technology products have the ability and potential to influence the world at scale. And that's what's really changing in today's world, is that we have power that's becoming more and more centralized in the hands of a few. And those few people are influencing the world in increasingly profound ways. And we don't really know yet what the long-term consequences of these, cultural shifts are, because we're essentially changing the way that we're interacting as humans. And so we must be having those hard conversations about those unintended consequences, about those ripple effects, both as individual consumers, as parents, as sisters, as friends, and also as employees and as managers and as a team member, like on the inside of these organizations, because all of us have to kind of, take the blinders off, essentially. Unless we want to just kind of be at the mercy of, whatever might happen with these, wildly influential and world-changing products and services. So yeah, it's very important, Erin.
When you said harmful products, my mind immediately went to social media and to software that pushes productivity, productivity, productivity. This also, when these practices erode trust and well-being and oppress marginalized groups, as you note, it also impacts return on income. It impacts business impact.
Yes, it does. It does. And I love using this term burnout. So burnout is we're seeing the effects of burnout manifest on a really, large scale right now. You see more people leaving the workforce, more people experiencing stress and just anxiety than ever before as we're navigating this pandemic. And it's not just people that get burned out, it's also organizations. And I think that a really important conversation I have with my clients is, what does sustainable growth look like to you? Because if we're trying to grow too quickly, then that's when we can burn out as an organization and literally like burn through our fuel, get to a point where we hit a wall, and essentially we're not going to be able to survive. And I love looking to nature to think about, to answer that question, what does sustainable growth look like? Because when you look to nature, as we so often should for lessons on how to conduct ourselves, I mean, you'll see that nature grows at a rate that is in harmony with its ecosystem. And so honoring how much we take, much natural resources we consume, as well as what waste products we're generating, and how that influences our ecosystems, really is the critical variable for defining what does sustainable growth look like. And there's a huge rise in companies and organizations that are aware of this now and thinking about operating in a way that is more in harmony with nature, so that they can stick around it and be in it for the long haul and lead in the next kind of generation of what consumers want and need from an ethically minded business and company.
I've been watching the trees outside my windows grow slowly, and I'm staring at a mountain and an eagle circling, which reminds me to have a higher view of things. And yes, please, corporations, executives, leaders, go for a walk in nature and take a picnic and some Lego.
Indeed, indeed. Take your team with you. Let's go on a field trip, and learn together.
You say you are an, forgive me, that came out wrong. You've used the words intersectional feminist, because I know you are. Words are so powerful. Would you explain to me what you mean by intersectional feminist? I'm not quite sure what it means.
Yes. So an intersectional feminist is a feminist that's committed to advancing rights of all women. And, the reason that that's important is that traditionally the feminist movement has excluded women who also belong to other kind of marginalized groups. So women of color. It's well documented that, when women first won the chance to vote, black women didn't have the chance to vote for another, 60 years after that, or something like that. And then if you think about disabled women or LGBTQ women or, femmes, there really are other groups that haven't benefited from the, how feminism has really helped women kind of enter the workplace. And you'll see this reflected in, statistics of women who occupy, board positions or executive positions at some of our top companies. Most of the women who have broken, through the glass ceiling, are white women. And It's really important to me that as women we understand that, yes, we are all up against the patriarchy for sure, but the patriarchy is very interwoven with white supremacy, with ableism, with a culture that kind of puts profits over people and planet. And I think that, as privileged women, and I definitely think of myself as a privileged woman, while I'm a woman of color, I also grew up in the UK, right? And I had access to a great education. And so there's certain privileges I hold that other women of color don't. And so it's really important to me that I use the power and privilege that I hold to help other women that haven't been as fortunate, because to me, I'm not a true feminist if I'm not thinking about all women, and really the women that have been the most kind of harmed by society are the ones who I think really deserve our advocacy and support the most. So yeah, that's what I mean by intersectional feminist. And people can look the term up. It was the term was coined by a woman called Kimberly Crenshaw, who likens like different systems of oppression as streets. So she's like, you could be stand like think about it as like you're standing at the intersection of a street. Like one street is the patriarchy and one street is white supremacy. And if you're a if you are a woman of color, you're dealing with both racism and sexism, and the combination of the experiences, the intersecting experiences of racism and sexism, are not just racism plus sexism, but there really are a whole complex alternative just dynamic that is important for us to understand. So yeah, that's why I'm proud to be an intersectional feminist and learning every day. I don't profess to be getting everything right, but I'm doing my best to educate myself and expose my own biases so that I can show up and be a better ally to others.
Well, move over slightly because I think I'll come and stand next to you and I might get my mail redirected there as well.
Sounds great.
Coming up, I'm going to talk to Jyoti about her sassy teenage girls as well as clothing because, hello, I have to sneak a couple of clothing questions in there anyway because we're talking about women and she's growing two beautiful women of her own. But just to allude to your earlier point, Asian and Indigenous women also didn't get the vote for a very, very long time. And let's not even get started on when women were finally able to get bank accounts and their own loans and their own credit cards. But speaking of money, I believe you wrote a very personal post about how you were impacted personally for being a woman and then taking maternity leave. Do you feel comfortable sharing?
Sure, I'd be happy to share. Yeah, so let's see. When I was in corporate, I took a management job, and actually had two incidences, while I was a manager, that basically demonstrated the fact that, there very much is a gender pay gap and there very much is a motherhood penalty. And, a lot of women talk about their experiences of how the system, we're hearing a lot about this system now, but how the system is not really set up for, equal pay and rights. And so for me, that showed up as, having a conversation with a male peer who was in an identical position to me and doing the same job, and was getting paid more than me. And when I raised concerns about it, I was asked not to talk about it anymore. And then another incident when I came back from maternity leave, which was an unpaid leave. I wasn't getting paid while I was gone, but my performance was rated for a period of time that I wasn't at work. And so, essentially, these are very subtle things that add up. And as women, we learn to kind of just tolerate and deal with, little bits of unfairness, even if it's just a small difference in pay or a half percentage point difference in how much of a raise we're getting, Over the years, that adds up. And it's one of the big reasons that we have such a huge disparity between men's and women's pay, is because if you look at all of these, small injustices that we face, and then add them up, over the hundreds or however many times that they're happening to many women, then that is, what a broken system looks like. And so, I was very upset about it, and I didn't know what to do with it, because as women, we're so often just, we don't want to rock the boat. We don't want to make things uncomfortable. We don't want to be the squeaky wheel and get blacklisted or get labeled. But because I was a manager, and because I had more power and influence, I felt it was my job and my duty to challenge the system and to speak to my leadership about my experiences. But unfortunately, I was asked to not provide feedback, and I was actually in a sort of passive aggressive way asked to be quiet and warned that I would be perceived as money hungry, which was really super hurtful. But it worked. I essentially knew that it wasn't worth me kind of continuing to speak up about it, because at the end of the day, I didn't feel safe to do so. And I think my story is just one of many. There's many more dire or more extreme examples of pay injustice, but for me, it's just the sting of knowing that you're already up against a system where you know that that system wasn't designed for you, and to be asked to be quiet when you're genuinely, speaking up from a place of wanting to make things better for others. It's just a tragedy, and it's one of the reasons I'm so passionate about all of us as women, as any kind of groups that feel like the system wasn't designed for us. Like, I'm very committed to us building collective power, because it's only when we connect together that we can kind of team up to redesign the systems, to challenge the systems. It's not something I can do by myself. It's not something you can do by yourself. It's something we have to do together.
That was horrific. That was unfair. That sucked. That shouldn't have happened. And I'm so sorry it did. I mean, to have it built into the organizational structure that your performance is still good even when you're not there, which affects your overall performance.
Thank you.
You didn't deserve it, and it sucked. And I can see the huge difference that you're making now. So thank you. I am going to bring us back to one of the powerful ways that you help women feel amazing, which is being a DJ. Yes, Jyoti is also a DJ, as well as being incredibly articulate and guiding world-class teams to develop courageous leadership and craft inclusive cultures and align to be bold collective visions. She has a meme playlist. So,
Yes.
when you're dancing with your sassy teenage daughters, and I'm using your words, I have to ask, because the fabrics are so divine that I want to roll around in them and lick them. Do you sulk in your sari? Are you sassy in your sari, or are you wearing something else?
That's a really great question. Well, so first of all, my daughters are 5 and 8, and
Oh.
I'm actually terrified of them becoming teenagers, and of course excited too, but we're not quite there yet. And saris, it's funny, we don't wear saris around the house, at least. We do a different type of dancing called Garba, which is a type of folk dancing that's from the state of Gujarat, which is where my ancestors are from. And so my eldest daughter Swara loves doing Garba and dressing up in her Indian clothes. And that's the festival of 9 nights is called Navratri, and it happens actually every fall, so it will be coming up soon. And of course, you know, because we're in the middle of a pandemic, I don't think that the events are going to be moving forward as normal. But yeah, in a normal year, we'd be doing that. But yeah, we play a lot of music around the house, and we wear, you know, whatever we happen to be wearing that day. For me, the music scene has always provided a lot of safety. You know, ever since I was 14 or 15, you know, I grew up in London, and I had a fake ID, and I would attend. The first club that I went to was called Bagleys, which was a huge warehouse club in King's Cross, London. And it was just, you know, then and still today, I love the fact that there are places that we can go to be fully expressed. You know, as my friend Emily Griffin would say, a dance floor is somewhere where you can fully express yourself, and there's not many places where you can move your body, use your voice, dress however you want to, and be accepted, kind of, you know, with your full freak flag flying. And so, yeah, for me, it's very therapeutic dancing, whether you're on a dance floor, whether you're on, you know, in a nightclub or in a warehouse rave, or in the living room with your young children with the music blasting. Like, any of those situations is a really great way to tap into your own creativity, your own expression, and to let go of, you know, the messages that society has kind of blasted you with, and in terms of how you should behave and how you should dance, and just do what feels good. So I think there's a lot of magic and learning in our, you know, various dance communities and creative communities. And for me, it's medicinal, it's healing, it's a great technique to regulate your emotions, to move through, you know, especially the negative emotions of grief and despair. Like, dance is a mechanism that's available to any of us, and humans have been doing it for, you know, thousands and thousands of years. So it really is, again, part of who we are as people.
And it's very linked to, oh, I love the London clubs. I haven't been there in a very long time, but Kinky Galinsky's was one of my favorites. And yes, you could let your freak flag fly, voted for clubbing. I even made it to Tramp, but that was a different dress code. But oh, London clubs and the clothes down at Camden Market and places like,
Oh, yeah.
so much fun. I was there when punk was still a thing, and we were moving into it, kind of into goth, and the intersection of that was a ton of fun.
Love it, love it. Yes.
You celebrate Diwali, but I have been, those are fantastic dance parties.
You're talking about Diwali parties.
Yes. And
Yeah.
with all the colored powder, and I ended up with hair that was blue for months because I'm a bleach blonde and I couldn't get the dye out. But it was so much fun.
Yeah, so you're talking about Holi, which is a springtime festival, and yes, it's so fun. We're actually thinking about doing a Holi party for my kids' school in the spring, because we're trying to bring some more spice and just multicultural fun into our school community. But yeah, you're right. There's just the colors, the music, the just unfettered joy and celebration is really wonderful.
The feeling, and I'm so sorry I got them mixed up. Diwali's a festival of lights. Like,
Correct.
feel free to virtually slap me with it with your DJ. I mean, I was going to say turntable, so feel free to throw a turntable at me.
I might hurt you if I do that, but I'll just Oh, you're good.
Oh, duck. Friend Emily of DJs, which leads me to, I've been dying to talk about the empathy tour.
Yes.
Oh, and you can go to the empathytour.co, and the tour is on now. It started on September 21st and it's going through to December 21st. And if you join the tour, you get a free guidebook which has 28 self-reflection prompts. and team activities. So please tell me about the empathy tour. How did that come about?
Oh, yeah. So actually it started last year. And so it was September of 2020. And so my collaborator, Emily Griffin, and I, we are both creative facilitators. We're both mums. We're both recovering from, you know, corporate careers. And we really wanted to pause, you know, through this kind of global moment where we knew, you know, leaders and organizations were asking the deeper questions around, you know, who do we want to be? Like, how do we want to show up as leaders through this moment in history, you know, given, you know, the pandemic, given the renewed focus on social justice, given the renewed focus on, you know, technology for good and mental health. And we very much see, you know, these large cultural issues as kind of a reflection of who we are as leaders, as organizations. And so we wanted to conduct a celebration and an interview campaign and start a movement, really. I mean, or join the movement. Like, there is a movement taking place right now of people that are tired of, you know, the status quo. They want to do things differently. And so through the empathy tour, we actually interviewed a series of executive leaders and founders from across the technology and social impact sectors. And we sought out and highlighted and celebrated leaders that were really using their lived experience of these, you know, thorny issues to shape change as business leaders, with empathy at the heart and center of it, because empathy really is the capacity to listen and feel beyond your own worldview. And, you know, we think that, you know, through this moment in history, it's really important for us to be listening more deeply to ourselves and listening more deeply to each other and listening more deeply to the world and what the world is saying. And, you know, the world is speaking pretty loudly right now that we do need to change things up. And so, yeah, the empathy tour was a celebration of those leaders and the work that they're doing. And we wanted to find out what those best practices are, what those leadership best practices are, so that others in our community, others that are, you know, following and joined the tour, could learn as well. Like, how do we step into this moment and lead with empathy so that we could create a more just and sustainable world for everybody?
And you've got Lauren Sarto on your website. We went on the Women's March together. She's fantastic.
Oh, Lauren is great. Yeah, and the work that she's doing through Ada Developers Academy, you know, so she's the CEO of Ada Developers Academy, and their mission is to infuse, you know, all of the big tech companies with underrepresented talent, with women, with people of color. And they have a direct pipeline into these organizations and provide training and career development services to get, you know, more diverse voices into tech. And they're doing some really great work. But yeah, Lauren's amazing. She's groundbreaking and a bold visionary, and we were proud to celebrate her and her work.
And a lovely human being. I just smile every time I'm around her. You've talked to some incredible people. Jump on the empathytour.co/blog to get a sense of some of these incredible people that Jyoti has interacted with. I'm going to put you on the spot a bit. Oh, and also make sure you jump over to her website, which is spillplay.com, spillplay.com. I'm going to put you on the spot a bit and say, would you mind telling us a self-reflection exercise to finish up this podcast? I did put you on the spot.
You did, and I'm going to think about, you know, the one that I've been really leaning into is, you know, so grab a piece of paper and draw a flower, like a big flower with 12 petals. And each of the petals should be labeled with various kind of facets of your identity. And so, you know, the petals would be labeled with age, gender, class, education, race, immigration status, ability or disability. Let's see, there's a few others too, but you're basically labeling them with all the different kind of facets of your identity, and then use those prompts to really reflect upon where you have privilege and where you don't. And you know, so often we just barrel through life without really thinking about who we are. And you know, the reality is that we're all very complex individuals, and how we show up in the world is a reflection of the combination of all of our life experiences. And depending on, you know, your race, your class, your education, your all of those things, you know, we move through the world in very different ways. And of course, there's, you know, so many variables that go into it, but choosing some of these big variables and really, you know, reflecting on who you are and how you identify is a good exercise to start, you know, breaking down who you think you are and how your identity kind of shapes and influences the work that you do, and more importantly, your deeper purpose, you know, why you're here. So that's a good one to start with. And it's been good for me to realize that, you know, all of us are a complex, multifaceted, you know, wonderful human beings. And one of the most important things that we can do, I think, is feel integrated and self-actualized and not feel like we have to hold back or compartmentalize, you know, one part of who we are in order to be successful. You know, for me, I've been feeling a lot more confident about celebrating my inner freak, you know, whether it's my DJ self, my dancer self, my, you know, wildly goofy or silly self. Like, these are the parts of myself that I want to celebrate and integrate no matter where I am, even if I'm in a room full of, you know, white male executives. Like, I want to feel comfortable being myself, because that's when I can access my full creative power.
I love that. Thank you very much. Everybody get a pen and a paper and start petaling. And there's something when you do connect your pen with paper as opposed to typing. And I am off to draw a very beautiful multi-petaled sunflower. Jyoti, thank you so much. I really appreciate your time today. And I really look forward to connecting with you again.
Oh, the pleasure was all mine, Erin. Thank you so much for having me out.
Bye. Aroha.
Adios.